This is Leslie Jenkins conducting an interview with Max Christmas on the 1st of November 2012 in Surfers Paradise, and this interview is for Surf World Currumbin. Max, can I start by asking you your full name, including your middle name, and your date and place of birth?
My full name is Noel Patrick Christmas, and born 26th of March 1939. In Brisbane.
And when did you move to the Gold Coast, Max?
I came here on holidays with my family when I was about 4 and 8 years of age to Kira, Coolangatta, and at Christmas time.
So you just came for holidays?
Holidays there, yeah. And then when I was 13, a buddy of mine, they had a house at Northcliffe, and the father was the president of the surf club, which is Northcliffe, and that's the first time I'd ever seen a ski surfboard sort of thing. And so they had about 4 of them in the garage, but old planks, that you might as well say, nothing like the present day, and they didn't have fins or anything like that. And we went out in the middle of, in the winter, and paddling on these skis and surfboards, and that's where I really got the bug that I liked it, and I was 13 years old.
And those boards that you were just describing, what were they made of?
They were made of ply, and they were made all through the 40s and things like that. That's what they used in the surf carnivals. There was no surfboard clubs, board riders clubs or anything at that time. There was no surfboard riders with the fins or anything like that. And how it all happened is that my father went to work in Sydney when I was 14. And I went down to Sydney and lived at Coogee. And Coogee Surf Club I got associated with. And I worked in Coogee there for 3 months before I came back to Surfers Paradise to start work as a carpenter. And I was 14 and a half something.
So when you were involved at Coogee on the eastern beaches in Sydney, were you involved in the Surf Life Saving Club?
I wasn't, but I used to nick down to the club and borrow a surfboard and get into trouble. And I was paddling surfboards down there, and they were a crack area of the best paddlers, if you like, in Australia. Coogee, North Bondi, Bronte and Maroubra and Cronulla. And I got to know just the feeling of that at a young age of the paddling side. And then I came to Queensland, and we lived around the Northcliffe area. And And then I started paddling in racing surfboards and that. And when I was 15, I won some open carnivals. And then at 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, I was state champion paddler. And also I was up in the top 3 or 4 in Australia paddling.
And how many hours a day were you spending in the surf to get to that condition?
I'd surf, I was basically an Ironman forerunner to the Ironman. I was a elite athlete, and I would paddle in those days training wise in the river prior to training in the surf in the sort of August, September area, and then I'd train in the surf and I'd paddle a long distance. I'd paddle from surface to Northcliffe to Southport Surf Club and back again. That was hard. I'd also run, and I'd run on the beach backwards, and I just didn't know anything. I was sort of trying to be able to race or whatever, or anything, participate in swimming, drill, R&R, represented Queensland in R&R. We won a title in that, and
were you involved in any of the surf clubs when you were doing this?
No, that's when I joined Northcliffe Surf Club.
Oh, I see.
When I was 15.
So all this paddling was linked to the surf club activities?
Yeah, and at that time the surfboard hadn't arrived. So I am the original of being on the way to Melbourne for the Olympic Games. We went to Avalon Beach in September of
56,
right? It was a Saturday afternoon carnival. I competed there against the Americans and the Hawaiians and different other nationalities as a surf carnival. And as it ended about 4:15 or so, the Americans came out with these short boards. They had six of them. And they were the first time we'd seen the short board in Australia.
Were they the Balsa Malibu?
Balsa Malibu.
Chip surfboards.
Yeah. And they rode them, six of them, rode them across the waves and just mesmerised us. We'd never seen anything like it. I'm talking about a big cross-section of Australian surfing guys. And that was there. And I was so proud to be amongst it that, you know, but we had no Balsa here.
And well, why did you decide to go down to Avalon? You went to Avalon and then to Torquay, didn't you?
To International Surf Race Carnival at Avalon Beach. And then then to Melbourne, where we raced again in Melbourne. But that was surf life-saving.
Yeah. Did you know that the Americans were going to be at Avalon?
Oh, yeah.
So that was planned to go?
Oh, and I knew who the teams were, but I didn't know they were going to ride a short surfboard.
And how much shorter was it than the boards that
we called a 14-footer, was the shortest one we rode for wave cracking waves. They were made out of ply. And all the Duke from Honolulu, he came here in 1922 or something. And he rode a simpler, hard, short board, about 12-foot, 14-foot. But whether it had a fin or not, I don't know. But I think it was just a plank. And here was the first time we'd seen anyone stand up and ride a board thing. But when they put the fin on the board, we'd never seen that. And this just transformed a whole lot. And where it all started from in Australia.
So what did it give? Was it manoeuvrability?
The whole thing is built on the fin. Mm. It's the power that drives it and stalls it. It breaks it, it stalls it, it twists it, does everything. And if you look out in front of my office out here, you see I've got three fins, plaques, they're big three fins. And really the fins, if you think about it, control the water, the sailing, the surfboard. The fins are to go to the moon. The fins on every aeroplane, and there's fins for the cars to stabilise them. And that's it. So the fin, and I organised that with the Gold Coast City Council. At the Art Centre, I was one of the committee members that interviewed the art, the designers, you know, and got the different designers down to, we got that one there. And then just by chance, they were going to put it in Raptors, not Raptors Plaza, at the Chevron Renaissance, and Starbucks. They didn't want it, and somebody else didn't want it, and I said, well, stick it in front of my place. So it's there now with the three fins, and it's got a thing for Max Christmas and everything.
Yes.
And also then what I did, I got designed the five surfboards of the history of surfing, which is in the mall. And I've taken them down now, whether they put them back there again or whether they put them on the beachfront or somewhere, they'll be somewhere. But that's got a lot of the world champions on it. And it's the pig and the different design boards that we had in those days. That was five choices of a surfboard. There was the gun, which is really going through the tunnel, you know, through the pipeline. That, and then there's the pig and the mal. And another jazz type thing. I can't think of the name.
But before the Americans came out, were you or any other Australians thinking about fins?
No,
it hadn't occurred
to you.
That's
why I say that was so. That's the launching of the fin in Australia. Mm. And from then, we all wanted them. So I was the one of, say, about six Queenslanders there that I wanted one.
Wanted one of the American boards.
Yeah, but I couldn't get one. And a friend of mine got one. Gordon Woods had one, I think, and I can't think. Bloke from Tamarama had one.
Well, I think Gordon Woods pursued his board down to Victoria. He was very keen to get one.
In Victoria?
Well, he went down to the competition at Torquay.
Oh, on that day, yeah.
Eventually the person who said they would give him the board.
So there were six of them left in Australia anyway.
Mm. Are there any still in Australia of those six?
No idea. But that's how small it was. Six were left in Australia. I got made, we couldn't get any Balsa for about 18, for 18 months or something. So I got straight away a ply board, ply built one, which was about 15 foot long, something like that. And we never imagined at that time that they'd come down. The Americans were around about 13 feet, I think. They were not 9 foot or 8 foot or anything like that. And then it came down, down, down over the corresponding period. Also what happened, we had the North End, I think it was the North End Board Club. That was at Naranik. And I was part of that. And that was the first surf board riders club. I'm pretty sure you check it out. And then come along others down south, you know, in Kira and that thing, I think, but I might be wrong.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what it was like at Avalon, what the atmosphere was like, whether there were many people there, and then what it was like when you went to Torquay?
Well, what it was, we had the carnival that started about 11 o'clock, 11.30 or so, and we had a low tide and it was dumping surf, and a terrible hard big wave dump. It wasn't a success, and the Americans had canvas race boards with a canvas, waterproof canvas race boards, and they had balsa race boards and they had ply race boards. And in America, part of the whole scene was in Catalina Beach, was a paddle around Catalina Island out of Los Angeles. There was a race that was traditionally went from the 30s or so, paddling around that, out and around that island. Similar, they used to have one at Coogee, around the island just off Coogee, a race around there. And but I think it was about 8 miles or something, a 16-mile paddle race. And as you probably know, there's a paddle race from Molokai to Hawaii, which one of our Australian Gold Coast guys has won about six times. So in the early days, racing a paddle board was part of the whole thing, which then they developed from there into the style riding, if you like, and the thrill of the riding and on those zip boards. The crowd there was, it was a big crowd because it was an international carnival, and probably the first international carnival ever in Sydney because of the Olympic Games.
Yes, well,
it was a practice for the Olympic Games.
Predated the World Championship in 64 by 10 years, didn't it?
But it wasn't that. Because of this low tide, the tide came in about 3 o'clock high tide. And the most beautiful waves were coming around, breaking green and going right across the beach. Well, they just went berserk on them, these six guys. We were just stunned. Stunned. That's how we all got introduced to it. I was one of the lucky ones to be there.
And what was it like when you went down to Torquay? Who were you travelling with? What sort of vehicle did you have?
We had a combi wagon, that photo in the combi wagon. I went down on that, and we went down.
Is that what you slept in on the way?
Yeah, yeah.
And did you
in a tent, yeah.
And you surfed on the way down? Or
no,
you didn't,
we only stopped
board
at Avalon and competed there, because, you know, it's an overnight trip to Melbourne, so you camp in the wagon. We didn't stop and surf anywhere. We were too busy, but we had to go back to work and get there and back again, you know. And then we lived in a tent at Torquay, and we raced on 2 days, and there was flat water. There was no waves, no board riding, no nothing. It was like a ripple.
Were people very disappointed about that?
No, we expected it. We expected Torquay to be, you know, like Noosa. You get odd days, you get great surf at Noosa, and most of the time it's flat water. Yeah. So we knew where we were going, but we didn't know about Avalon being a big wave that day, and that was really, if it hadn't been a big wave or the dumping surf, they wouldn't have been able to perform. Because they were just crashing out, you know, short, bang, 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 they'd lose their board. So it was just spectacular, the perfect wave, the perfect ride, and it was like the introduction to the whole new world.
Mm. Did you get to know any of those Americans very well?
No. I did later on, a guy called Perry, used to ride with us at Greenmount, and he was an American from Arizona. Yeah, Arizona, no, I can't think of the name of the city. He was a very kid. He was about 19 or 20, and I was about 17, 18, and we became friends. Even today, he's still over there. But he came every year for a few months. He used to go up the up to New Guinea and get the art crafts out of New Guinea.
The artifacts and
things.
Yeah,
artifacts. And he's a collector, and he's now one of the biggest collectors of all those things in the United States and sells them.
Mm.
So we were still in touch, Perry, Mike Perry.
And so after Torquay, you came back to...
We came back and just had to get one of these boards. So I got one, and I got it in the wintertime, I think, when I got the board from Barry Bennett. Because he was making the surfboards for me, and I was racing them. I was like the professional, something, if you like. I'd get a discount on a couple of boards a year, skis a year or boards or whatever, and I'd sell a few boards for him. And that's when I was 17, 18. And so I rode Bennett boards, and he never had a competitor that could be up in the top three or four, you know.
Did you ride Gordon Wood's boards too?
No. But I knew Gordon well and Billy Wallace well. I knew everyone, and they all knew me because I was a good surfer, and I was a very good board rider.
So who was the first person to ride the short boards at you?
And that was a ply one, and they used to stand on the beach, and I'd go to surface because there's more people there, and ride across a wave like that, and they just gawked at it, and they'd want to touch me. I thought I was some freak or something. It's true.
And when did Balsa become more available?
Probably, because I then went to Balsa as soon as it arrived, yeah. I think it was 61. 61, it might have been the Balsa. For some reason, we couldn't get it imported because of the requirements of timber and that sort of thing. You know,
quarantines
and things like that. So it took a couple of years. We would have bought it straight away, but you couldn't buy it. That's all. So that sort of made it where we had to go for these ply boards to get anything at all and then get to the Balsa later.
Mm.
And that foam came in. Foam came in also. And Barry Bennett was the one that cracked it for the foam, basically. And he became the operator for all the foam for Australia. Yeah, all the boards, it went to Wallace and all those guys bought their foam from him.
And when you were going surfing, which beach were you mainly surfing at?
We'd always go surfing about 4:30, and we'd surf on high tides. And we knew the tides. So every second Saturday, Sunday, we had a high tide at, say, 6:30, 7 o'clock. So we'd go Cabarita. We'd drive to Cabarita. Cabarita we would eat, and Greenmount. This one here was a sand break. Currumbin came later. Kira always had a rip running across it. So you had to paddle up against it a lot, but it was a great wave when I was there, but you had to keep moving up with the rip at Kira. That's this part of the journey, you know. All beaches have different styles and things. But we knew the tides, the sunrise, and we could surf at the best hours, 2 hours or 3 hours, before the winds came and things like northeasters or southeasters or whatever they may be. So we're absolutely disciplined to precisely surf at the right time and get the best of nature, the wave and the formation. Because it's a different thing altogether surfing on a shallow 1 metre low tide. There's no big kick up to me. That's hard. It's good right when you're a kid or a grommet. It's ideal. And they learn that way. But not for getting a good, hard, curl wave and this and that, like you do at Currumbin or you get at Kira or you get at Greenmount or a Snapper.
And what was it like surfing at those places in the 50s? Were they pretty pristine and uninhabited?
Yeah, they were. Well, there was nobody. It'd be maximum to see six or eight boards out there.
And what about Cabarita? What about the track to Cabarita? Was that...
Cabarita, that's Bobbingar.
Was it a dirt track?
Yeah, sand. Part of it was sand, part of it was bitumen. I'm trying to think. We didn't have four-wheel drives, but it was because of the sand trucks they had it was bitumen down to the bridge there at North Kingscliff, you know, South Kingscliff. Then you got up to the mining places there, and there was some bitumen. And then further down, you'd get in, and sometimes you'd go off the road, down along close to the creek, which, funny enough, in those days, was full of staghorns and beautiful tropical plants or something. And you go through it because it was firmer along the creek. So if some parts of the sand you could get through, but you'd get down a sort of more sand and mud. It was harder on a trek, which the locals and the various ones had made, the tractors and various things go through there. So we never had any trouble getting there.
And did you camp there when you got there?
No, we'd get there at 4:45 roughly, and 5 o'clock, and we'd surf till, say, 8:30. And it had, in those days, had a perfect, beautiful wave. Probably better than Snapper for some reason, but the sand and all that thing. Then it changed into something messy with a northeaster and this and that, and wasn't. But you had to get the good southeaster there to get the right surf, like a lot of the points, you know.
Do you think the sand mining, even though that was on the foreshore, had any
Didn't
made
bother.
Any difference?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. Because Broadbeach had sand mining. So what's the difference between Broadbeach being all sand mined and I think to a little bit at Main Beach, it was sand as well, inside, you know. In Crumbin, the Newmans, they mined all the beach sand. Because it in Cabaret in what is it down there at not Kingsley Boggan not Boggan Cabarita see where the sand miners there, they never went to the beach. They didn't knock down the sand dunes. They worked from the sand dunes inside. And what happens with the sand is it keeps replenishing the mineral, the zircon. It gets washed back under through there and repeats itself every 4 years. So when it doesn't, how much they took out, it'd be reloaded with that sand again after 4 years.
Mm.
And but they took it off the beach at Crumbin. They had the license to do it at Crumbin off the beach, on the north side of Elephant Rock. And I don't know, the Newmans were very good at that sort of stuff, and they were very good local guys. And they were all surfers as well.
Mm.
So they all surfed as well.
And tell me a bit more about those early days. Was there lots of marine life when you went out?
I used to dive when I was 15 with Ben Cropp, so I did know a bit about that too. And we dived there, about five of us had dived there. I was only 15. The other guys, Ben was about 18. And we'd dive at Fido Reef, I think you call it, at Kingscliff. So the Coogeon Creek comes out there. Straight out the front, there's a whole big line of reef. It was full of fish and gropers and God knows what, beautiful tropical fish, beautiful. And four of the guys became national champions at skin diving, so I was with the best.
Oh.
And Ben Cropp became famous and still is famous, you know, for all the things he's done in the whole marine world. So,
and was your father happy for you to spend as much time as you did in the surf? Was he also
a
surfer?
Board
rider?
He... I just surfed in those early days at the weekends, but I'd take my surfboard to work as well. And I'd work a shift where I'd have an extra half hour at lunchtime. So I'd have an hour and a half if the surf was on. And often the jobs I worked on were in surface or on the beachfront. And I'd take my board and we'd go surfing there or in front of surface beach, you know, from 12 o'clock to 1:15. If the conditions were right, but often it was low tide and there was a big wave or something, or the wind or something, so it wasn't every day. But I surfed and trained every night at 4:30. I didn't surf 7 days a week for a long time. And then I stayed in the surf till I was 45. And I competed the last time and at the surf boats. In the national titles, and I came second in Queensland when I was 44.
So,
45.
So it was a long time
competing
and surfing.
And competing and training and all that sort of stuff. But I trained, I enjoyed training because I used to hitchhike to Sydney to race because there was no planes and no money and no bridges and time. But so I'd hitchhike to Sydney on a Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock. I'd get to Sydney about 10 o'clock. I'd race at 1 o'clock. And I'd hitchhike home at lunchtime on Sunday. And that's the only way I could keep on top as a top athlete to compete with the best down there. So when I went to the Nationals, I was, you know, I was in the top group. But if I'd stayed here, there was competition, but not as savage as those guys, right?
Mm.
They were just that good.
Did you ever think of moving back to Sydney?
No. I was only there 3 months, but
yeah.
I made a mess of what I didn't know, which came back to me, not to haunt me, to bless me. The connections I made surfing Australia-wide through surfboards and board riders and life-saving came to when I started my real estate company. I had enormous clientele. So if they ever want to buy up here, that's a C-Max.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Interesting.
So we will go back to that in a minute. I just wanted to ask you about your time making surfboards, which was in 1959 to 1960.
It was wrong. It's wrong. It was 61 to 62, I think it was. It was because I was the manager of a block of units at the time. And in the garage, I used to make them in the garage when I had time. And I created time to make them. So because a lot of the guys wanted a Max Christmas surfboard, because I was quite a name at that time.
And how? What were your boards like? What did you make them out of? How long
foam.
And then you glassed them yourself,
glassed
did
them
you?
Stuff, yeah.
Did you ever have any problems?
Yes, I did.
Skin irritations?
No, I didn't. Sometimes I made mistakes with the boards, or the foam didn't come up right, or I burnt the glass was too hot or cold or whatever. It was always... Look, because I was a carpenter and like a lot of the guys, tradesmen, we knew what to do, so they did agree and we shaped them and this and that. So,
And you had no power tools like you do today, did you?
No, it was all hand done.
So you'd plane the glass off, would you? And
not
then
the glass,
sand it?
Sand it off, yeah.
So how long would it take you to make a board?
I don't know. Those days I'd probably make one a week or something like that.
Yeah.
One a week.
And how much did they sell for then?
Oh, I don't know. I had an idea of going into business. I got the shock of my life. Because I had a name, which is like a brand name, which is Max Christmas. For surfing, and then that carried into the real estate as well. And what happened is that I went to Woolworths, Myers, and I found out what it was. But let's say they sold for, I don't know whether it was £15 or £20 or something. The Honesty was out of the manufacturer that used to make them after me. Honesty boards, they were made near the Miami school. Whatever, there was a tax, this and that, and they wanted to have make an order of 500, and then you had to pay this, and they didn't buy them, you make the 500 till they sold them. And I said, this is big time, and I'll be at their mercy. And so that's when the boards really didn't go into the shops. But I'd ventured in there to see what it was like, and said, no. So they built their own shops and put their own factory and shop together. That's how it stayed. Is it a cottage business or a backyard type manufacturing thing? Mm-hmm. And as some of them emerged or got together, it got bigger and bigger and bigger. So one thing I was going to mention, Mitchard Farrelly, he now sweeps a surf boat at Palm Beach in Sydney. He's not a bad sweep, surf boat sweep. Which is a transition, like I was a board rider to a surfer, and then I was a surfer, but at the same time a board rider.
Yeah.
And then I transferred into the surf boats.
Yeah.
And then I did also, what I did was formulate with Keith Williams the outrigger canoes. And I bought out the two best coaches to train our teams for a month on the knack of the paddling. But because I knew about surf boats, the knack of surf boat racing, that it was this easiest, and that went all over, and we went on to win. And a lot of the best steerers in the canoes were all surfboard riders.
Oh.
So the knack of the knowledge of the surf and the currents and the ocean floor created a knowledge that became the knack of that. Now I had surfboard riders as my canoe paddlers, as my steersmen. They could relate and feel the ocean better and the whole system better.
Mm.
And the other thing I found, that you become so alert from surfboard riding that they probably overlook it, they don't take it for granted, but you had to know the weather, the wind change, and I was in the water that much. I could feel like a little puff of breeze on down there.
On your leg.
The wave, I would notice there, going from there.
Mm.
2 or 3 metres just to my left or so. I would then move into there and I'd crack so many waves by that 2 metre move, the peak.
Mm.
I became very famous as getting the absolute ultimate position to take off. So that's one of the things. I carry that through into business with economics and various things and the wind changes and the various things and the business change and things because the ocean teaches you that.
What, reading the ocean is similar to reading the market?
Yeah. And I just laugh at the paperwork, the papers, and they read it. So far out of touch. And you can be the best board rider. And the same thing applied to the surf boats. I had a skill of moving across or over or around or through a rip or this and that in using the water.
Mm. Well, some board riders who continue to ride boards for decades and become very involved in the surfing culture in the 70s or whatnot, describe it as a spiritual experience.
It's a spiritual experience, yes.
So do you think of it in that
definitely.
Way? Yes, definitely. But do you think it's different then from your other experiences that you've just talked about?
What do you mean?
Being in boats and being with a team. And
yeah, team.
Whereas you're an individual on your surfboard, you make your own decisions.
I found it in the paddling side. Lonely, because I used to win all the time and I didn't like it. At the fast start of it, for the first couple of years, I would go sometimes 2 or 3 years unbeaten in the racing anywhere. And you walk up the beach and there's expected, it becomes lonely. So I said I'd rather be in a team where we enjoy it together.
So is that one reason you...
That's why I went to the boats. But I was only 17 when I went to the boats.
So your time riding a surfboard, how long was that before you went to the boats? You only did
We didn't do both.
Oh, you did both.
All I used to do in the surf carnival, I'd run on the beach, I'd do the drill, I'd paddle a board, I'd sweep the surf boat, and I'd swim in the surf, pull a belt, all that sort of stuff.
All right.
So I just did all the things they do as the Iron Man. And always be in the top three or so.
Yeah. And which clubs?
Northcliffe. Northcliffe
always,
was the main one.
Always.
Then I went to surface. I didn't do any serious thing for a couple of years after I went to surface. And then I started the boats again. And I stayed with the boats till I was, you know, I put on weight and I was too big for the surfboard and the paddling and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So you've got to be like a jockey or not a jockey, but a lighter person and with the strength on the board and that sort of thing.
Mm. But sometimes some people who are very involved in surfing, especially during the, say, 70s, they didn't want to be involved in surf clubs.
No, that none of them wanted to be.
But did you ever have a problem being involved in
both? No, I like
the
discipline.
Both?
I like the discipline and the discipline trains you for business. As well, if you
and the rules and regulations,
and all the rules and
the
regulations, and
of
all the
what
rest
you could do.
It's there, and you've got to, stay within the barriers. Like it's like the army, you're going to be stupid at it, or you can be good at it. But if you want to qualify to get in the team, you want to get this and that, you've got to be good at it, and you've got to and perform. If you want to go on a number of events, which I just one or two events didn't satisfy me, and particularly if I went and raced and win, so what? So then fortunately, I was on the boats. The boats, I became quickly the state champion of the boats and always a threat anywhere. I was a regular, if I walked on the beach because of my knowledge of the wave and the ocean and that, I'll be a threat to anyone and the skill. And I would get out there when none of us get out there, you know, things like that, because I knew the ocean.
Did you ever have any accidents?
Not serious, no.
Bad incidents you recall?
No, you know, I've cut eyes and chins and things like that. A few stitches here and there, but we never. We rolled, but I taught them, all of them, what to do to save themselves. And they stay in the boat and get down low. And as she rolls over and over, stay there. And then as soon as it stops, just come up and calm. But they, I trained them in discipline, I'd drill them, discipline everywhere. You know, I'd walk them in the water, the boat rowers, you know, to get the feel of the water with the legs, switch their minds on.
And to work as one unit.
Work as one, yes, to work as one, which is great in business, in the theory. But if I put it down to today in business, in lots of the jobs, the politicians, the various things, no one really knows the job or is game to step out of line to try something new or do anything. It's all sort of like in all that talk, and it's not, it's a bit, they're all scared, you know. And there's so many things that are changing in the world that I'm abreast of. Like I used to watch surfing and the canoe paddling and any styles, and also the designs in styles, you know, like the designs of the fins and things like that. As we change with the fins all the way through. Even though I was riding and doing nothing spectacular, but I was still always sharp and aware of any changes and in with it, you know, right up to I was 40 years of age at least.
Do you think you contributed to some of those changes?
With the surfboard I did, but that was new. I didn't have many to in the surfboard. It was new, and I, like the foam changed, and the bolster came in, and the bolster went out, and the foam stayed, and things like that. But the shape of the fin was always the key. So I knew that, and I used to always talk to the guys about the fin, and the length of the fin, the thickness of the fin, and the different fins. They're always experimenting with the fin. They have three fins. They have two fins. They have one fin. You know. So constantly, the thing was on the fin.
And do you think the leg rope made a difference to surfing?
I think so, yeah, definitely, because it shortened up swimming to the beach and all that sort of stuff, you know. So there was no leg ropes in my day, and it was a headache because what would happen, you would be missing out on this time to get the board and get back out there again with a rope, the leg rope. It just meant you only had to swim a few paces and actually go and bang, so you lost. Did you lose 15 seconds or something, 20 seconds, whereas the other way, you lose 10 minutes sometimes. And that was precious time.
But do you think it also allowed people who weren't very good to get out in the waves?
What a day that! I remember teaching a lot of people, you know, how to get out.
Teaching them to surf?
No, how to get out there to surf.
Right.
The V is deterrent.
The paddling that, to get out
paddling there. Yeah, paddling to get out there. Because imagine if you couldn't paddle. And one of the reasons I was very good at it, I was known to get out in any big wave. And they used me in paddling sometimes against machines, if I could beat the machine, like, you know, the rubber duckies and those sort of things. But in today, any of those guys there are super fit with paddling, because the quicker you can paddle out and retreat and paddle out again, you're on this time zone. So the strength of a paddler, and my strength was I was a super paddler, so I could out paddle anyone to get out there and in and out again quicker than anyone, which meant that I'd look, say, 1.5 better waves than they would, because they didn't have the strength to paddle. Yeah. But young guys, when they were 10, 11, 12, Druin was one of them.
Peter Druin.
Peter Druin is one. I taught him. Well, they were little 11, 12-year-olds. Mickey Stafford, Fuller's son, and two others went on. Cohen, I think his name was. He'd been a great surfer. Another one went on to be a big wave rider. But they were either 13 or 11 or something when I taught them. And also I was associated with Carla Gilbert and Trevor Hendy. I brought a coach in from Sydney for them, a bloke called Mick Pora, and he transformed the whole paddling board thing and surface and the Ironman and everything on his coaching.
And what technique did you have with paddling that gave you... That meant you were a winner all the time. Wasn't just your strength, was it? It was technique as well.
Yes, technique. But what it is you've got to read the ocean. You've got two things you've got to do. You've got to know the ocean floor. So in a surf boat, which is the same as riding a surfboard, you have to know how to cut to get the best out of the wave and how to cut the wave. And you've got to know the sand where it's at. And you know where it's going to run out so you can spin back in again. And with a surf boat, I used to do the same thing. And you would not, yeah, you'd get on the shoulder, we call the shoulder, and then come back in, and this and it. Also going out, getting out quickly is let the tide, every beach has a trench sucking out, as the waves can, it's got to suck out. Well, you just, sometimes they couldn't get out, but I'd cut across the back and out that way, into, you know, go 20 metres down the beach or 50 metres down the beach, sideways, which looked spectacular. And, well, zoom, out I go, it'll be first, you know.
Yeah.
And the same with the technique swimming, or with the surfboard. So you work to recover, to get out quicker, you get into the channel that sucks you out, mm-hmm. instead of hitting the wave. So you teach the kids that, to read the bottom of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
to get the best. So psychologically, they will know the bottom of the ocean with their feet and the fin, out of this.
Well, Peter Drouin went on to have many successes
mm.
and be in a couple of Bob Evans films and things. Mm. Did you stay in contact with him?
I did.
Would you say you were a mentor?
I was. Yeah, I was. And he desperately wanted to work with me in real estate. He wanted to go to real estate. But honestly, he didn't have any ability in that area of understanding that.
Business acumen.
Yeah, none. And I don't think he used to hang around me, you know, when he was 28, 30 years of age, 32 or something, but he didn't show any promise at all.
And what about other surfers that were, you had close ties to? Who were they? Were there others?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them.
Did you have anything to do with Rabbit Bartholomew?
No, knew of him and that sort of thing. By the time I was in my 30s, and he was, say, 15, or I was 35 or something. Maybe more like 35, and he would have been 15, 18. My world had changed into children and business.
Mm.
And so I was probably 80% in that area. I was only 20% in beach and surf and riding a surfboard. I ride a surfboard all the time, but never to the fitness of the magnitude or...
Mm.
But I know by the time I got... Once I got scared in two places, a big wave in Sydney. I know I was body surfing that stuff. I didn't go out, but the guys were all national champions, about six of them, with me. They went out and couldn't get it back for 2 hours. At Bondi, the waves were that big. I pulled out through common sense there. Another time at Northcliffe, when I was about 50-odd years of age, I was going on this big, wild surf, and I was going out on a board, and I turned back and came in. I said, this, at my age, could be dangerous.
Yeah.
I've been two times when I said no.
Mm. So how did you become involved in real estate? Because you were a carpenter, weren't you? Did you finish your apprenticeship?
Yeah, finished the apprenticeship and worked for 2 years in the 60s, and... just elevating it. 2 years in the building trade, and then everything crashed in the building trade on the Gold Coast. Everyone was out of work and this and that. We had a massive crash, and everyone went broke and this and that sort of thing. So I said, I don't like this. I don't like this. So I went into management of some things, and I went into a caretaker's job, which paid good money, gave me time for freedom. I made the surfboards then. Then I went to a grocery store. And at
Surface or?
At Southport.
At Southport.
And then I went into, but I had two kids at the time, married. I was 24. And then I went to, I decided to go into real estate. So this, yeah. Yeah, you're making a noise, that's all. Okay.
And you decided to go into real estate?
Yeah, I like the look of real estate. And my mother was part of it. I was bottom of the class all my life. And because we changed schools all the time, my mother kept thinking she was a real estate person behind selling a house. And so I had to move schools.
So did she move in the...
In Brisbane.
Oh, but
when
so,
I was young.
Oh, I see. So she moved around Brisbane, but it still meant you had to change schools.
Yeah, yeah.
Suburb to suburb.
So I had to meet new kids in it. For better that, being a shy kid, not going to this and going to new schools all the time. I think I went about 9 or 10 different schools, you know. So that, it was just fortunate I got out Michelle.
Was that with your father and your mother were still together?
Yeah.
Was it? Why did they keep moving?
Well, she thought she was a bit smarter, buying a profit of houses, but she
did
wasn't.
She?
No. So when now anyway, I took a liking to real estate that I and I didn't want to work inside with in the post office or railway lines, where my uncle was in, and I wanted to. I didn't see any future in Brisbane. It was really a backward place, and I liked the beach, that surfboard thing. So that changed my life. So that's when I was 13, I liked that, and they listened to me, and I said, I want to be a carpenter, and I want to listen. And then I went to real estate, but I went with the best. And in surfing and with everything I've ever done, I've trained or learnt from the best, the top guys in the business, you know.
So was that Laurie Wall in those
Laurie
days?
Laurie Wall was that guy, he was the best.
Yeah, because he was very entrepreneurial.
Oh,
wasn't
he? super. And his gift was he knew the behaviour of the human being. And there was two things that he knew well and how you could sort of get to understand them. His greed and sex. And he combined those techniques to the reason. And then the other two things on top of that was taxation and banks. So to get people to talk, it's psychology. He taught me to ask the question if they liked the bank and the taxation department. They both things, they hated both. And that had caused their downturn. So they told me the truth about why and what they wanted to sell. And greed got them into the problem. And sex got them into the problem. And four things. And that turned me into a knowledgeable, brilliant salesman.
So how long did you stay working with Laurie Wall?
I was with him for 6 years.
Oh, quite a long time.
Well, not 6 years, about 2 years, actually. But I became his dealer then. So I showed a bit of promise.
Because wasn't he subdividing some of the canal estate?
No, he did. He did some
selling the property,
work,
yeah,
so then I was involved in all that for him, and so he would ring me and he'd say, "We've got a problem." It was always taxation, and I've got to sell this and I've got to sell that. What are you going to do? What am I going to do? But I had a great understanding of it, and all the clients I've had is a great human understanding of them, similar to the ocean.
Mm.
Understanding the bed of the ocean and the wave.
Mm.
And that's been my simple difference in achievement. And also I could read the market when it's going down. I still can. Like this market collapsed in 2005, not just lately.
Mm.
And it'll recover in 2015. Not for another 2 years. But the signs are all there now, just for the start. But it won't show up.
So do you think it's good to buy now then? But bad to sell?
Yeah, well, it's good to buy, but where it's gone wrong, where it's gone wrong here now, that all the things have been loaded on the people to own real estate. And if you've got a mortgage, it's all you did. And I'm talking about the rates and the every other ingredients and all the things they take the tax off you in and all that thing. They've left the people with very little. And so I say, don't buy real estate, put your money in it. But that, they could not understand. Here is a guy that, yeah, but I did tell people not to buy at certain times because it doesn't go up all the time. And you can only make money if you buy in downtime. Well, we answer the question, later this year, when the interest rate's 4.75%, no rush, start to buy something. September. And it'll do nothing till about the following September, and all of a sudden it'll jump up.
Now, just getting back to your career in surfing, is there anything that I haven't asked you about your career that you wanted to comment about now? We've mentioned some of the.
I think you've done a good job. The main thing is
famous surfing people of the time, but not
many.
not Mickey, no. Michael Hickey, Scott Dillon, John Cunningham, Ron Halpin, Peter Donnelly, George Bevan. They were all competitors, weren't they?
They were competitors. They did surf on boards at the time. Johnny Cunningham. You've heard of John Cunningham?
No, I haven't, no.
He's a famous lifesaver, beach guard for the Gold Coast City Council. Cunningham was a good board rider. He used to board... there's only about six or seven board riders. Another one suicided recently. Mick Gay. He was in back in that time. You know, there was only 8 or 10, and there was probably about 20 or 30 from Sydney.
Yeah.
And there would have been two. Troy. Peter Troy, his name come up at all?
No.
He was a great surfboard rider from Victoria.
We've got down Bob McTavish here, but would he be a contemporary of yours? He's 60...
He was later.
66, I think.
Yeah, he's 10 years later. He was at Noosa. He rode at Noosa. He was the famous one to open up Noosa.
Yeah, and to develop the three fins, wasn't he?
Yeah, and all that, yeah.
He's down in Byron Bay now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've saw him not for some time, but McTavish, we always had, like, visitors. We had two or three from Sydney where Bluey Mays was a great one. He was a good rider. From Tamarama.
Yeah.
And there was others.
So were there close connections, do you think, between the Queensland surfers and the surfers of the Sydney beaches?
In my case, there was. Because I was well known in Sydney.
Yeah. Because you were always competing.
Yeah, and all those guys were surf club guys that were on the boards. See, there was no surf, there was no board riders clubs.
Yeah.
They came later.
So were you involved in the board clubs as well as
the
surf clubs?
Well, I was involved with the one at... I don't know to what extent, to tell you the truth. I don't know whether I was the president or something, but... what do you call it? North End, it was called. And a bloke called Alan Curtin was involved in that. And he made some boards too, I think. Alan Curtin.
Yeah.
So he's from Southport. And there was board riders in Southport Surf Club.
Did you know Joe Larkin?
Yeah.
He was making boards too.
Yeah, Joey Larkin.
A board rider.
Joey Larkin, Georgie Bevan. I'm not sure where Larkin was from, what surf club in Sydney. But every one of them was from a surf club.
Freshwater.
Or Freshwater, okay. Larkin, if there were 7 or 10 out there, it'd be one of those ones I'm talking about. Not one of them, it'd be three quarters of them.
Mm.
Sometimes there'd be six, sometimes there'd be 10. But that's all there was. Then there was another batch who were just sort of getting their feet, you know, getting crossing over, if you like, coming into it.
Did you know Phyllis O'Donnell?
Knew of her, but not...
Didn't
not
know her well.
No.
I suppose there weren't very many women surfing at all in those days. Except
none.
No. Okay.
I don't know when the women. What time did you come into it?
Phyllis won
75?
The International World Championship in 64.
64.
In Sydney.
Yeah, in Sydney. No, I didn't. I knew of her, but see, when it really burst on the scenes was with. Nat Young, and what's his name? What did I call his name before? Nipper Williams. Nipper. He's the beach inspector, surf boat sweep now at Palm Beach. I mentioned his name before. Nat Young and he were the first two big ones. Druin was the first one that made a name, and then came. Those two about 3 years later, in 65. These other ones I'm talking about were there was no board rider clubs.
Mm.
So there was no board riders. And they were just a new fledgling thing about 61, 62. But they did have the North End Club going in the maybe 1960. And I don't know for sure that, or whether Kira had one There was a Kira Board Riders Club, and I'm sure there would have been a Greenmount Board Riders Club, but what year is that, I don't know. But they were never recognised until in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the 50s.
That's right. Okay, if there's anything I haven't asked you you'd like to talk about now, otherwise I'd like to thank you for your time this morning.
Well, it makes me think. I don't practice anything. I just, when you ask me questions, it comes out, you know. And I do wander a bit between, as you can see, with how it entrenched my life like the animals.
Yes, how it influenced every aspect of your
life. And I just see today, nobody seems to have, no one ever puts that as part of. And they can't understand why they can't get there.
Yeah.
And it's academic, but you can't be academic without knowing the leaves on the trees and the various things and the birds and all the things around you. And the ocean, as you, like you said, it's a...
ecosystem.
Yeah, but it's a, what's its name? It's a...
spiritual.
Spiritual. Definitely is. Definitely is. And I'm not spiritual, but it's because it's so close to nature, I am.
Thank you. Just wanted to add that last bit you were saying about your preparation for a race. You'd go and look at the surf 2 days beforehand.
I'd go and look at it two days beforehand and see at the time of the race, which is, say, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock or one in the afternoon, at where the tide was and deduct the time of the tide differences so that I'd be racing. Then an hour before I raced, I'd go up and look at, you psych yourself into that, various parts of the ocean. They can give you an advantage, and where the level of the water is and why the waves are breaking like that and where they'll be in this thing, and where to head for when you're coming in. You see swimmers and various things will head up north, this and that. They'll have that in them, and or allow for the wind to push you around and all that sort of stuff.
So you were very strategic in your planning?
Yes.
Then and in business?
And in business. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.